The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
I now want to explore two very significant aspects of living a life of faith. Now remember, what is faith? Jonah mentioned the other day, well, if Torah is the basis of my faith, then I explain, Torah is not the basis of your faith. The basis of your faith is you. You are the basis of your faith. When you experience you, and since you are a part of God, a ray of divine light, then knowing you would automatically mean knowing God, even though they're not one and the same, but they are one. And that one does not achieve emunah, it's not something that you have, but rather emunah, which is being translated as faith, is not what you have, but it's who you are. It's not something you achieve, it's something you experience. And if a person is trying to get emunah, they're very confused. And if a rabbi is trying to give you emunah, he's very confused, because that is assuming that you don't have it, or actually, to be more correct, you are not it. You are a living manifestation of emunah, right? Which is an awareness of self, a self-aware being. And as a self-aware being, you would be aware of the fact that you are part of some one greater, or actually a one greater than yourself. And we learned that Rav Kook explains that emunah, faith, is the most basic self-revealing of the essence of the soul. Okay. Now we go back to Rav Kook over here. Rav Kook says something very interesting over here. He explains that all clarity derives from faith, and faith is initially a composite of fear and love. Okay? So all clarity comes from faith, because faith is that realization of yourself, and all clarity comes from your ability to see. So your ability to see as a soul is going to determine your clarity. Yes.
What does clarity mean?
Understanding it. Right? Just understanding. Nothing deep here. Just understanding, right? It's like the light that lets you read. Okay? So your mind, you as soul, are, you know, the hard drive in your life. Hashem's really the hard drive, but you're part of that hard drive. And then everything else is the software that you need to read. But if the hard drive is not functioning, right, or not plugged in, then certainly can't read the software. I mean, sometimes you get an email and it looks like gibberish, because whatever program you have is not reading what's coming in. So too, there's the, you know, that program that reads, and then there's the program that's being read. But I'm sure somebody could understand it better than I in computers. But I want to understand that faith is initially a composite of fear and love. And that word fear is a real good put-off word when it comes to religion. And we want to try and understand. So if you say light, if you say that faith is light, it's awareness itself. Okay? It's awareness of who you are and what you're, or actually who you're part of. Great. But let's say the spectrum of the colors of this light is fear and love. Just as white light has blue, and that's why we can see blue, right? If there wasn't the color blue as within the spectrum of white light, we wouldn't be able to see blue. Okay, so now think of faith as a light that enables you to see, right? And the dimmer the light, the less you're able to see. And realize that faith is really that self-awareness. But now that self-awareness is a composite of fear and love. Let's say there are basically just two colors in the spectrum of this light of yourself, which we're calling emunah. We got that? Okay. Well, what is fear and what is love, and what does that got to do with faith? Okay? So first of all, I definitely need to qualify that the English translation is problematic. As is always when it comes to the word yira, because the word yira is almost always translated as fear. And that's unfortunate, because there's two other valid translations of that very same word. Yira also means reverence, and yira also means awe. Okay? And so these three words are very different. Fear sounds like punishment, sounds like recoiling, feeling threatened. Okay? Reverence certainly doesn't have that baggage to it. And awe, all the more so, is a whole different experience, which we'll try and understand in a second. But I want to try and first just get to what, let's just leave it as reverence, let's not translate as fear. And I'll readdress the reason why it is also translated as fear. But right now, let's call it love and reverence. Okay? How can we understand this in the experience of the journey of faith? Because really what we're saying is to find God, you really have to first find yourself. And as soon as you find yourself, you will find God. If you are a ray of light in search of yourself, then when you would finally find yourself, you would know the sun. Because you're a ray of the sun. Does that make sense? Okay? Alright. So now, let's do something really nuts. Okay? I want you to imagine one of these huge building cranes. You've seen them, you know, that pull things up, move things around. At one end is this huge ton of bricks, you know. And so it's kind of short on one hand and then long over here, and it's got that. You all know what I'm talking about, right? But now we're talking about an electrically powered crane. And you'll soon understand why I'm saying this. It's not a tank. It doesn't have gas in it. This is electrically powered. It's connected to some electrical cable. All right? So now let's say this electrical crane begins to have self-awareness. Okay? This would be something out of, like, I don't know, some science fiction movie. That suddenly this crane becomes self-aware. So what would this crane intuit about itself? It doesn't know it's a crane because it had no self-knowledge, right? So this is something very new. Suddenly this crane begins to become self-aware. What does this crane begin to intuit and know? Self-evident, directly, without a doubt, about itself. What do you think? What do you think the first thing it would just know about itself? Yes?
Strong and big.
That's right. Well, I know I'm strong and big, so probably intuits that I'm significant, I'm powerful. All right, what else would this crane intuit about itself? Yes?
I am.
Okay, I am. All right. Okay, it somehow knows I am. And now it's trying to get, well, I am powerful. Okay, what else do I know about myself that I just know? I mean, I'm not reading any books about this. I haven't gone to Crane School and met any of the rabbis that, Rabbi Crane and Rabbi Bulldozer. You know, I'm just totally on this by myself. You know? Somehow it would intuit that I'm here to do something, right? I'm a vessel and I have a purpose. It would just intuit that. That's something that it would know about itself. What else would it know about itself? Yes?
My source of power is from somewhere else.
It would experience that, I don't exist alone. Everything about me is somehow bound up or connected into some other source, greater than or other than myself, right? That's what it would just know about itself. And so in this journey of this crane on a spiritual awakening of itself, right? So what else would this crane know about itself? Yes, David, were you ever a crane? Because you get this really well. Okay.
I have cables and stuff and they're used for something.
Right.
I have seeing mechanisms.
Yeah, I'm complex. I'm well designed.
Right.
I'm very impressed with myself. I'm very well designed, very precise, and what else did you say?
I have the resources, the machinery, the pieces, parts to work with.
Okay.
To do
I have something to do and I'm able to do. What else?
I'm not in control of myself.
There would be the sense that I'm not in complete control of myself. Somehow I don't do this by myself. There's some partnership going on. Now, of course, whoever's running me can't do it by himself either, because he can't lift that on his own. And look at me, right? But it would be pretty silly if that crane found itself lifting up this huge bundle of metal beams and think that this is me and me alone. It would experience that somehow it is not alone, and that somehow it works in consonance with or in partnership with some other power that it intuits is not itself. What else would this crane know about itself as it comes through this journey of self-awareness?
That it's part of the unit, a whole, and it doesn't work exclusively by itself.
Okay, it senses that it's part of some bigger picture, right? It would just kind of sense that about itself, because it sees some bulldozers over there, and they probably are stupid, they don't understand themselves. And then there's all these other things here, but they're not cranes like me. But what would it experience deep inside itself, which would probably be very frustrating and extremely challenging if you were a crane? Now, I could have come up with a shaver or something. I'm talking about cranes for a very specific reason, right? Because what would a crane experience about itself? Well, it would know it has a purpose. It would know it has a purpose. But what would it experience within its own inner dynamics? Yes, Kathy? I'm not sure it would know what it's not, because it was never a bulldozer to know that it's never been a bulldozer. I'm not sure if it would have that kind of consciousness. I mean, of course, Kathy, if you were a crane, you would be able to figure that out, right? But yes.
That it cannot control itself. It's being controlled by this human being, this person that's inside of it. It can't move on its own.
All right. So it doesn't feel that it is the master of its destiny, but it does feel somehow it's deeply part of, and whoever his master of destiny is has to work with him. Like, you have to work with me. Okay, but if this is something here, but that I'm being very specific why I picked the crane. Because what would it experience about itself in terms of its own inner dynamics and its own workings? What? No, it doesn't move.
It's not leaving the space that it is.
Okay, yes. But what about the fact that it functions on tension? That it really is completely tense. Because there's a side of it that is pulling it down, right, which are these big ton of bricks on this side of it. And yet there's this whole other thing about it that's trying to reach out and lift up, right? And that's really, this balance over here is created by attention. Do you get that? You can get into the mind of a crane. Okay. All right. Well, so there is this tension that it would deeply experience about itself, which I think is actually maybe the first thing it would experience about itself is, boy, I'm tense. You know, there's a side of me that's pulling this way, and it's really short. And there's a side of me that's really long. I look like weird, because on one hand, I've got these two energies going at me, pulling at me. I'm trying to pull things up. When I try to pull things up, this tries to pull me down. And you would feel extremely frustrated. I would say this crane would probably go see some crane doctor. You know, get some crane therapy. Right? Cranial, whatever. Some cranial massage. Because this crane would experience this incredible sense of tension. Okay? This is our experience. We have, within the experience of ourselves, a tension. The tension is between yira and ahava. Reverence and love. Because as a ray of light, as a ray of divine light, there is something about me that naturally yearns to be part of something greater than myself. And yet, on the other hand, within me is a deep sense that as much as I want to be part of that greater self, I'm not that. Right? And there's a tension here. And that is what yira and ahava really in its essence is about. Ahava is this this draw, this yearning, this attraction to connect, to become whole with that which is other than me and greater than me. And yet then, but there's another part of me which recoils, that retreats, that moves away. Because as much as I want to be part of that, I know I'm not that. Okay? Because as much as I'm one with God, I'm still not God. So that realization that I'm one with God is love. And that realization that I am not God is fear. But not fear that I'm being threatened, but the sense like, hey, you know, like I'm not everything and there are boundaries. And I've got a higher power to answer to. I've got a higher power that I'm drawn to. But on the other hand, I have this higher power that I kind of answer to. I feel great being part of the great, but I also feel small knowing that I'm not it all. Right? And that is this tension when you realize yourself. The human soul experiences about itself that it is part of a greater reality, and yet it is only part of a greater reality. So you feel a little overwhelmed in the presence of that greater reality. You feel a little challenged, maybe very challenged. And there is this, we could call it cha-cha-cha. There's a kind of like three steps back and three steps forward, which in fact is the way we pray. Right? Because there is a certain recoiling, there is a certain realized feeling that, whoa, you know? And there's something beautiful about that. Recently I was in the Hamptons, and my host, wonderful people, they said, let's go to the beach tonight, which is great when you're Orthodox Jew because ain't nobody on the beach tonight. So we went off to the beach, and there was nobody on the beach. And so, deserted beach, sand as far as you can see, and full moon. So you see the moonlight reflecting off the sea and the waves and the crashing. And it was just me and this fellow, and we climbed up onto the lifeguard's tower. And we're just sitting there. Right? We're just sitting there. And so this fellow who is not Orthodox, right? But these words mean nothing really in the end. You know, he says to me, I just love feeling the vastness of the universe. I just feel so tiny. So I turned to him and I said, is that a good experience or is that not a good experience? He said, oh, it's the best. I love it. And I said, well, just keep that in mind because that's called Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. That is a moment of recognizing God as revealed in the name, the Yud, the Hey, the Vav, the Hey. Right? That's a very powerful, beautiful experience. But that smallness isn't a bad experience, but you still know that you're small. So there is a year, there's a sense of reverence, there's a sense of real humbleness. Okay? A real sense of humbleness. And this is really what Emunah is. It's a combination, right, of the experience of oneself, which is this yearning to be part of a reality greater than myself, because I know I am a reality greater than myself. I know that I am part of reality greater than myself. And yet this is also, there is this reverence, there is this humbleness, there is that sense of even overwhelm, a little bit of a retreat back, right? In recognizing that I am a part and only a part of that greater whole. And so I got to know my place, right? And that is what I believe Rav Kook is explaining over here. All clarity derives from faith, and faith is initially a composite of fear, but not fear in the sense of being threatened or someone's trying to hurt you, but fear in terms of yira, meaning recoiling, retreating, humbling, reverence, knowing your place, knowing you're part of the all, but you're not the all. Okay? The soul, any questions on this before I...
Can you translate this fear?
I didn't translate this. What?
So if you were translating...
I would put reverence. I would put reverence. I think that in this context of what Rav Kook is sharing, that's more what he's referring to.
But if you say faith, I have an association.
Right, I know. Well, because I'm really, that's right, because we're really trying to redefine emunah, and faith just sounds like blind faith, an idea that I bought into, whereby really emunah is a profound knowing of oneself, a deep experiencing of oneself, and in that deep experience, and there are no doubts. Faith generally means, listen, it doesn't make sense, but I buy it on faith. According to Judaism, emunah is the greatest level of absolute surety. There is no question in your mind, right? Because it is your mind, right? It is you. It's not what you think, it's what you are, and you deeply experience it, and there's nothing to talk about, because it doesn't lend itself to just a discussion. It's just, I know that I am, and I know that I am significant. It's like one philosopher once said that even though everything from without tells me I'm nothing, something deep within tells me I'm something. And it's just something I know. I just can't accept that I'm simply a meaningless being floating in the universe, just a speck of dust. Even though people might behave that way and treat others that way, but deep inside, I just know that. And that is emunah. That is a deep, self-evident knowing of God. Because I know that I'm not all, but yet I know that I am not nothing. And I just know that in some way I'm part of a cause, a reality, a power greater than myself. And yet, still, it's not me and I'm not it. It's just a deep knowing. And therefore, I'm glad you brought that up, because really, emunah isn't faith in terms of, well, I buy it on faith, scientifically I've got nothing. Emunah, according to Judaism, is even greater than science. Because science is something you're observing. Emunah is something you're experiencing. Right, and you have no doubt about it. There's nothing. There could be no argument, and there won't be a new experiment that will prove your theory wrong. Right, it's something you just so neatly know from within yourself. Okay, and part of what you know about yourself and you experience is this desire to love and to feel connected to that which is outside or other than you. And yet also a natural inclination for reverence, for fear. It's a natural awareness. And we want it. We look for the experience to feel in a sense of awe and reverence and even like, whoa, like what am I? Because it's very self-confirming, because I know that's just the way it is. I'm part of something greater, but I'm not the greater. And so I feel love for the greater, I feel connected, but I also feel very humbled, right? Very humbled. I feel empowered by feeling part of the greater, but I also have a sense of surrender to a greater. And that's the fear part, it's the surrender. Love is asserting. Fear is a little bit more of a letting go, right? I'm not the master, I'm not in control. There's a power that knows better and is higher than me.
Surrender.
What?
Surrender.
Yes, surrender. So the soul in its inner being senses that faith, love, fear and love in their essence are directed only towards the divine. In other words, all feelings of love and all feelings of reverence or awe are really oriented only to the divine. What does that mean? I mean, if I love this painting. So I love this painting, don't I? No, according to Kabbalah, the soul is only interested in one thing, which isn't the thing at all. It's God. So that's all the soul's interested in. You, as a ray of light, are only interested in being a ray, a vehicle, an expression of the sun. That's all that interests you. Right? Because that's everything you're about. And therefore, everything that people are into is only a search for a connection to God. That's what Judaism believes. Right? And there's just a confusion here. And I speak about this in much greater depth in my book, Seeing God. Because really, when I look at a painting and I say, oh, that's so beautiful. Is the painting beautiful? It's just this painter has the ability to take colors and lines and somehow organize that in a way that suddenly this spiritual quality called beauty becomes expressed. But what is beauty? Beauty is one of the attributes of God, one of the spectrum, one of the colors in the spectrum of divine light, let's call it. And therefore, when I'm attracted to a painting, it's not that piece of paper or the paint that's attracting me, it's really God, who has become manifest through the painting. It's really the aspect of God's beauty that's being manifest through the painting that attracts me. As a soul, as an aspect of God, I am only drawn to an aspect of God. That's what Judaism claims. Okay? When you see a handsome man or a beautiful woman and there's an attraction, so if he says, oh, she's so beautiful, she's not beautiful. God is beautiful. And this particular person is a vehicle, a channel for God's beauty in the world. So it's not the woman that is beautiful, but it's really, once again, that she is a ray of, a color in the spectrum of God's light. And that's what's drawing you as a soul to that aspect of the ultimate soul, God, being manifest through this woman. But God forbid if this woman dies, she's no longer beautiful, right? A dead body isn't beautiful, right? But because she is an expression of godliness in the world, it's the godliness that you are that's connected and drawn to the godliness that she is expressing, okay? But you can meet somebody. I remember there was a woman who I met from another learning program, and I invited her for a Friday night dinner, and she was a model. And I forgot who else I had invited to the dinner that night. And as we're walking back from the cocktail, I'm remembering slowly who I invited. There was Shmuley, and there was Yossi, and there was... I realized I invited all yeshiva boys, right? And I'm going to walk in with one model and seven yeshiva boys who all day long are looking at Gemoras, you know, Talmud. I thought, this will definitely be a very interesting evening. So we walked into the house, and she was walking behind me, and these guys were all sitting, you know, in the living room, and they fell off the couch as I walked in. I thought it was me, but I forgot she was behind me. And we sat at the table, and all the energy was kind of very clearly focused on this woman. And one of the fellows asks her a question about herself. I knew that they're not going to be interested in the parsha of this week, the portion of the week. And one of the guys asks this girl a question, and she begins to talk, and you could just see this kind of exchange of glances amongst the guys, and they kind of like, and they turn to me, Rabbi, tell us about the parsha, about the portion of the week. He said, because even though she was a vehicle for the manifestation of divine beauty, she wasn't a vehicle for the manifestation of God's intelligence, okay? And there was a loss of interest in her. She wasn't quite a striking manifestation of God's kindness. I mean, so you know, you can sometimes meet a person and feel initially attracted to them, and then after a while not feel attracted to them. You don't know what happened, right? Because what really initially attracted you was really the godliness, that aspect of God that they were revealing, and then you realize that they aren't quite whole in revealing the total truth of God in the world. So the soul is only interested, only drawn to, right, that connection to God, because that's all we're interested in, according to Judaism. That's all the soul's interested in, is being who I am. I am a ray of divine light. I am connected to the divine. I am in service of the divine as a vehicle for the manifestation of the radiance of the divine into the world. And I can't help but want to be that. My only choice in life is, do I do that in a real way, or do I confuse myself and do it in a way that isn't so real, right? Or maybe even not real at all, it's just a counterfeit way. And then some way it connects, it catches up with me. So the soul and its inner being, sense of their faith, fear and love, in their essence are directed only towards the divine. To whatever extent these values are encountered towards other objects, it is all made possible through some illumination from a divine spark that reaches there. So if I'm attracted to this painting, or if I'm attracted to this person, or if I'm, or if I feel kind of reverence and awe of this person, it's not this person, and it's not their wisdom. Right? Have you ever been in the presence of someone who's just got such incredible wisdom, and you feel, you know, a little intimidated, you feel humbled, you feel reverent, right? But it's not their wisdom, right? And that's not a bad experience. Very often that's a very good experience. I think I would love to, and do love to be in the presence of people that I feel, whoa, you know, and I take a step back, whew. But really it's not them per se, it's they as a vehicle for God's wisdom, because none of us can say this is our wisdom. We're just a channel for God's wisdom. We're just a ray of divine light that does not start with us and will not end with us either. Okay? So therefore, that's all that interests us, is the divine. And if something does interest us, like if we love to ski, then you have to ask yourself, what is it about God that you're sensing in your skiing? Okay? And then you have to ask yourself, is this really the most genuine way to live this and experience this? Or is this something that's nice to do on the weekends, but I certainly wouldn't make my whole life out of this? Okay? So I had an amazing experience where there was a woman doing Israelite. She was becoming religious. And then she knocks on my door, Erev Rosh Hashanah, the day just before Rosh Hashanah, the night of Rosh Hashanah. At the eve, and she's freaking out. What's wrong? She said, well, I don't know. The other day, you know, I'm really getting into this Jewish thing, and I'm really excited about it. I'm really trying to do this seriously. And then the other day, I was at a friend's house, and she put on a video of Madonna. And I was really challenged by and very disappointed in myself that I was mesmerized by Madonna. By her dancing. This was a woman talking, right? By her dancing. And it challenged me because I thought, well, so am I really serious about this Judaism thing? And why did I sit there and watch it and enjoy it and feel connected to it, right? But I said, well, why does that challenge you so much? She said, well, I guess, I said, well, I understand that perhaps you were just tuning into a spark that was there, right? It's not a lifestyle. But maybe you were just sensing a passion there. Maybe you were sensing the harmony in her movement, in the movement of the dance. But what is that? Right? So I said, oh, don't freak out. I mean, don't turn it into a religion or anything. But on the other hand, just honor that there might be a divine spark there. Because the truth is, anything that attracts us, it could only be because there's a divine spark there. Right? Now the question is, do you realize it's just a spark and this is not the way to get the light? Or maybe, as Rav Kook says, when a person does tshuva, when a person returns to Judaism, and they're feeling that they kind of gave up something, and it's hard for them, and they're feeling some draw to that, some pull back to that, and they don't understand why. So Rav Kook says it's because they didn't do complete tshuva. Because they didn't do complete repentance. Because there must be some divine spark that's in that activity that they have not figured out a way to access in some other kosher way. And that's what's drawing them back to this. Okay? Because that's all that really draws our souls. Right? That's all that really matters to us, is that connection and that experience with God. That's all that really matters. I mean, I've shared with many of you, in terms of my own search for God, it really, I would say, mostly manifests itself in rock and roll. It was going to rock concerts. And there I was amongst thousands of people, and just, you know, give me the Beat Boys, free my soul, want to get off on your rock and roll and drift away. It was my religion, right? That was my sanctuary. Maybe these were my gods, my idols. But there was something very genuine that was happening there, or something that at least was very similar to what I knew I was looking for, is I just wanted to feel part of a bigger story. I wanted to rock with everybody else and feel that we're all swaying and we're all in rhythm. And we're all somehow together in this. And that when you look around the stadium and people would be holding up a match, you had to hold that match. You know, excuse me, if I can have a match. And you just felt so good. Because in some way you were manifesting in some activity an inner truth that you knew. That I'm just a little match. Now why would you want to be just a little match? Because you are. You're just a little ray amongst all the rays of this brilliant sun. And you just want to live a lifestyle. You want to be part of a happening that reflects that, that expresses that, that enables you to remember that. That's all we're trying to do in our lives. And there was something really very powerful and very spiritual, and I thought at the time very genuine in that moment. But then afterwards, what people were doing to each other, you know, stepping in on each other, and you know, it's like, what happened to this moment? Weren't we all matches together in this one light? You know, I'm getting into fights with people, and people weren't sharing their pot. It was not nice. Just joking, right? But there wasn't this real feeling of sharing. There wasn't this real feeling that we could take this to the world. There wasn't this feeling that I could do this every day in my life, but I had to pay like $15 just to get into this place to do this. But there was something about it that there was a spark. I was looking for a spark. And some people just get stuck there and don't realize it's just a spark and this is not going to take you to the great stadium and be part of the ultimate concert and the real song that's going to play forever. But there was something there. And so I was only looking for God. I just didn't know I was looking for God. Right? It was like I saw in the brochure of Livnot Lehibonot, they had a quote from one fellow. He said, you know, I was always celebrating Shabbos. I just didn't know it was on Saturday. I didn't know this is the way you do it. But like the celebration of Shabbat, we're all finding some way to find inner peace, some way to feel connected to a reality greater than ourselves. But are we finding the lifestyle to genuinely do that and do that and do that? But that's all we're interested in, is the divine. We're only interested in being ourselves and who are we? We're connected and expressions of God. And so we just want to think that way and act that way and speak that way. But show me a lifestyle and a community that's committed to that. Because that's what I believe the Torah community is and the Torah lifestyle is. Right. And, you know, and Steve brought up an interesting point about all these various personal growth seminars, which there's so many of them. And they're packed. And you know what? Packed with lots of Jewish people, too. You know, a very high percentage of the Jewish people there, not only participating, but leading them. And I remember this one woman who was very active in one of these organizations. And she was, in fact, one of the leaders of the organization. And suddenly, she got very turned on to Judaism. And now she's living a full Torah life. And I said, well, what was missing? Because the wisdom that this particular organization shares, I've read some of the material and there's some very good stuff there. She said, bottom line is they didn't have Shabbos. She said, like, I didn't feel I was part of a historic movement, a community and a historic movement. It was like, we do our thing because our teacher says that. What was his source? What is it connected to? And so I felt like, but when I realized so much of what I was looking to accomplish in these personal growth things was in Judaism all along, but not only did it teach this, but it really had a system, a technology, but a world movement, an historical movement. Like suddenly I found that it's not like just I will celebrate Shabbat in my little home by myself, but anywhere I go in the world, I could always find a place to celebrate Shabbos with other people who also play this format, right? Sing these songs, light these candles. And she said, this movement just couldn't offer that to me. This organization couldn't offer me that. Interesting approach. So to whatever extent these values are accounted towards other objects, you know, whenever we feel love or reverence towards an object, you know, if you feel in awe of this incredible masterpiece, it's only because it's just a piece of the master. Right? That's the only reason you're in awe of it. Because it's not a masterpiece, it's a piece of the master. Right? And the more you start realizing every flower is a masterpiece, and even more important, every person is a masterpiece, Because we're all just a piece of the master. Right? Then you realize what has always been driving you, and you realize that faith, emunah, is the fundamental drive, which is the drive to just be who I am and be awake to who I am. Faith, next paragraph. Faith in God is the most exalted concept. Actually, I wouldn't use the word concept. Actually, I would say the most exalted way of thinking. Because of its profundity, it is lowered to reach all levels, even the lowest. It is interpreted on each level according to its capacity of comprehension. In other words, you know, when I was a child, I comprehended things as a child. But it's still me. Right? When I was a teenager, I comprehended things now according to what a teenager is. Okay? And now that I'm an adult. So, that's the interesting thing about the external articulations of that inner knowing. Which is, as you grow, those external articulations change. As I was a child, the way I tried to externalize and become cognitive of God was being with a long beard in heaven. That was the way I formulated a picture that somehow gave my inner sense of and drive for connectivity, right? My sense that I'm not the master, my sense that I'm not everything. That's how it became externalized in concepts. Do you follow that? But as I grow older, and I'm still trying to articulate and formulate this inner knowledge of who I am, right? I begin to get maybe forms of, well, maybe I can't believe in an old man floating out of, maybe it's a cosmic energy, right? And again, I'm just trying to express in words the ineffable, right? Find some kind of images that would reflect what I know is ineffable, right? And so, but then that doesn't quite fit exactly what I know to be true, but can't quite articulate. Because this is really the challenge of the life of Emunah. I am trying to articulate in words and concepts the ineffable, right? I just can't really communicate who I am or who I'm part of. I really can't say much. I'm just banking on, you know what I'm talking about, right? It's like they say that Coca-Cola is so successful because nobody can describe what it tastes like. You can't describe what Coca-Cola tastes. You can Snapple. Well, you can say, well, it tastes like kiwi. Okay, well, it tastes like cherries. But Coke doesn't taste like anything we know. And that's what they... What?
Tastes like Pepsi.
No way, man. You're not part of the new generation. Oh, you're actually part of the new generation. I'm still classic Coke. But it's just an indescribable taste, which they found in research on why is Coke being so successful, is because it's so indescribable. It's like God. No, I'm just joking. Because that's beer. But no, ale. But
it's the real thing.
It's the real thing. Right? And we're trying to find the real no thing, right? The total spiritual. So the indescribable, as we go through our lives, we're still trying to describe it because we don't always have that experience and we need to talk to each other about it to create a community. But that's the power of faith, which is it's so exalted that it can be expressed in very low forms, right? It's like when my son talks about God in his very childish way, there's something very true about what he's saying. But as you grow older, you got to realize that that's not going to work. Right? For me, in my life experience, and now I'm able to explain things maybe to myself and others in a more abstract way, right? And so, this becomes the challenge of a religious evolution of the human being. Emunah is basic. It's natural. It's just who you are. It's a knowing of who I am and what I'm part of and who I'm part of. My life then is to try and cognate that, try and figure that out, communicate that, express that, capture it as best as possible in words and in concepts. But then the words and the concepts need to evolve with me as the intensity of my realization of who I am and who I'm part of becomes more evolved. And that's when things break down.